No one said entrepreneurship was easy.
But honestly, let's be real about it.
Hi, my name is Varun Balsara.
And I'm Luke Nelliclift.
And we are the hosts of the Human Entrepreneur Podcast.
This is the podcast that unmasks the human behind the entrepreneurs.
We uncover the skills they have learned,
lessons they wish they knew earlier,
and stories that will motivate, inspire, and sometimes shock you.
Entrepreneurship just got real.
Welcome to our show. Hey Luke, just thought I'd check in. How are you doing this week? Yeah, Luke, thanks for asking. I think same as you, got done with a few assignments, feeling a little light. But as you know, the essays keep coming. The work keeps piling up. And I think I'm really proud of YEM as well. I think it's been an amazing journey. The community is buzzing. Amazing webinars, amazing talks. And for those of you listening and interested in the YEM, do check it out. We'll probably be putting it up in the show notes as well. So onto the main part of this section, you know, I think Eric has been one of the biggest guests that we have spoken to on this podcast. And it's a very interesting story that I must tell you before you watch this episode. Originally, Luke and I record these things, as you might know, if you're a regular listener here. But this time was a bit exceptional. You'll probably see me doing most of the talking. And there's a very specific reason for that. It's the fact that Luke's microphone just stopped working in between. but look, I must say, you know, you took it in your stride really well. You made a very interesting reflection that, you know, I personally found really inspiring. You said something along the lines of, you know, it's just great to have this new feeling of just being on the podcast without actually physically actually talking or conversing with the guests. How did that feel? You know, talk to us about your reflections, because it's always interesting to, while we might, you know, joke about it and, you know, in the moment it was awkward, but, you know, your reflection is very key, which is why I bring this incident up. Great. Thanks so much for your vulnerability, Luke. Always appreciate that about you and, of course, your optimism. On to the show. Hey, guys. Welcome back to another episode of the Human Entrepreneur Podcast. This episode is super special. We have with us Eric Edmedes. Eric is a serial entrepreneur with experience including wireless networking, military research, Hollywood film production, and award-winning and life-saving medical simulation. Today, Eric is a leading authority in behavioral change dynamics. Eric has created and consulted on some of the most effective, transformative, and high-rated educational products and live events in the world. Widely recognized as one of the most powerful, engaging, and entertaining speakers in the world, Eric has shared the stage with Sir Richard Branson, Robin Sharma, and President Bill Clinton, not forgetting to mention that he has his very own masterclass on Mindvalley as well. His dedicated and passion for improving the quality of human lives all across the world was the inspiration behind his flagship program, WildFit, globally recognized as the most effective health transformation program on the market. Eric, welcome to the Human Entrepreneur Podcast.
Hey, thanks very much for having me.
Eric, you know, we always ask our guests before we begin, what's their elevator pitch? What is your elevator pitch?
Well, you know, it's funny. I like the idea of the elevator pitch. I lived in the UK for a long time, and I happen to know you're not allowed to talk to people in elevators there. So I never developed one. I'm kidding. I think the old school model of an elevator pitch where you have to try to, you know, distill what you do into one sentence for an audience who has no idea who you are and you don't know anything about them doesn't really work anymore. So I will tell you that in my world, my elevator pitch is a question, and it would be to ask people in the elevator, what are your biggest problems right now? You know, what are your biggest goals? What is it you're trying to achieve? Where are your obstacles? Because by knowing more about the person I'm trying to speak with, I'm going to come up with the correct elevator pitch for them. Most people, I think the elevator pitch is about them. And I always think the elevator pitch is about the audience.
That's a very interesting perspective, Eric. I don't think we've heard that one before. I think you raise a very valid point. Tailoring your pitch for your audience is key. So let's say you had to pitch me as a potential customer WildFit. What would that elevator pitch look like?
Sure. WildFit for me was a natural extension of a childhood curiosity. And what I mean by that is that I had a number of interests converge. The one was that my great-grandfather had found the oldest Homo sapiens skull in history, 259,000-year-old early human. I was always really fascinated by that as a kid. I was interested in fossils and human history and evolution and that kind of stuff. And then separately, I had a real fascination also with health, you know, because in my late teens, early 20s, I was not healthy. Consistently, I was unhealthy, and I was on a variety of medications and therapies and treatments and stuff to deal with those things. And I managed to turn around all of them by changing my relationship with food. And then this third interest of mine came up, and that was, let's call it behavioral change. It's like what causes somebody to change, or what makes it difficult for somebody to change. And those three things all kind of met about 2011 or so, when I was teaching business through our company, Business Freedom Academy, and I was teaching entrepreneurship mostly in the UK at that stage. Clients wanted to know, like, where do I get all my energy from? How can I fly around the world and I don't do jet lag and I don't get sick and I can be on stage for 10, 12 hours a day and keep pumping and what have you? And so I started doing lectures based on the research that I'd done about nutritional anthropology, but I found it frustrating because you could tell somebody like, well, look, if you want more energy, you want to miss less days off, work sick, and you want to feel better, then, you know, eat more of this and eat less of that. And you'd bump into them a month later and guess what? They weren't doing anything you told them. Here are some rules. Nobody can follow them. And so I started asking a much more empowering question that was, how can I actually help people to make these changes without having to rely on willpower to make them? In other words, wasn't there a way that the information could be given to them that would almost in a sense write directly to their subconscious thought processes so that they didn't have to use willpower to not eat junk food? In 2011, 2012, we experimented with that idea with eight test clients, and those eight led to another eight and then another eight. And all of a sudden our clients were telling their friends and the company just started growing exponentially. And that's, you know, now we're at a stage where we've had, I think 30, 35,000 people do our program in 130 countries around the world. And it's working.
That's very inspiring, Eric. And I think you tackle a very important facet of just well-being, which is food and nutrition, which I think is often quite misunderstood. And sometimes people don't even pay attention too much. I personally have been lacking in that area as well. So if for someone, you know, who's a young entrepreneur who is in university, you know, relies on ordering food and whatnot, what exactly is the advice you'd give to them? And why would you say diet is so important?
There's so many different ways to, you know, this is a good example of the elevator pitch conversation. Like, let's say I have an opportunity to talk to somebody about health. So what's the first thing I want to say to them? And of course, what most people do is say, I can help you lose weight, or I can help you feel better, or they would make some attempt to pitch. What I would want to do is find out why somebody cares. What is it that makes somebody want to revisit their relationship with food, or what pain or suffering are they dealing with at the moment? And the funny part of it is that a lot of the difficulty people are suffering with at the moment, they don't even recognize that it actually does relate to food. So we really kind of have to start there. Obviously, in the area of weight loss, that one's fairly obvious. I mean, people are buying diet books. They've been buying them for 30 years. They buy one, they try it, it doesn't work. They buy another one, they try it, it doesn't work. And then one day they promise they're never going to go on another diet again, and they're just going to accept themselves for the way they are. But then, of course, their doctor says to them, you know what, you're pre-diabetic, and now we're going to have to put you on metformin. And, you know, there's this cycle. What I really attempt to do for people is to try to have them understand what's in it for them. For some people, it's about peak performance in sports. And other people, it's like they really want to improve their memory and cognition. Other people want to improve their sex drive or fertility. Everybody has different reasons for wanting to optimize their health. What a lot of people don't have is belief that they can or an understanding that they can. We've come to accept that sickness is normal. We've come to accept that one out of three people are going to die of cancer, and one out of three people are going to die of heart disease. And the fourth leading killer in the Western world is iatrogenic death, which is just a fancy way of saying medical error. And so we've just come to accept that that's the way it is. And it doesn't need to be that way. Here's one more way to think about it. Let's say the three of us, you know, we wanted to do like they have that coffee for comedians. Let's say we were going to do this podcast, but we were going to drive. We're going to drive from London to Moscow, where it's quite a drive we're going to do. So what are we going to do? We're going to go check out the car. We're going to make sure the car's tire pressure is good, the tread's good on the tires. We're going to put good gas in there. We're going to make sure the oil's been changed, good quality oil, brake fluid, you know, antifreeze. We're going to make sure that the car's needs are being met so that we have an A, increased likelihood of getting to the destination, and B, we're going to enjoy the trip so much more because we're not going to be on the side of the road fixing the car all the time. That is not the way most people run their lives. Most people don't put the best fuel in on a regular basis with any thought to the journey that they're on or the quality of the journey and so forth. And as a consequence, for a lot of people, it's absolutely normal to get the flu twice a year or once a year. It's absolutely normal to feel lethargic or tired at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It's kind of normal to have some inflammation and pain, maybe a little bit of autoimmune disruption, maybe sex drive waning a little bit, moods flying all over the place. Like, we've just accepted these things as normal, and it's just because we're not taking good care of the vehicle.
So Eric, how do you get so much energy? How do you go on working for so many hours, traveling, don't do jet lag, don't do sickness? What is that secret? And do you think it all starts with diet?
Well, I think that there are two really big driving forces. The one is, if you've got a really strong passion for what it is you want to achieve in the world, then that is an energy source. My friend Anders Haglund is a great speaker in Sweden, and he always says this thing of, if you need a motivational speaker, if you need motivation to get something done, it's probably because you don't want to do it. And so if you've got a tremendous passion for something, that's going to be your first energy source and a huge one. But at the same time, if you haven't taken good care of the body, if you're not well hydrated and you're not oxygenated and you don't have good nutrition and you're dealing with a bunch of toxicity, well, you know, then everything's going to be difficult no matter how much passion you have. So what I've really done over the last 30 years is looked into what I would suggest is we might call nutritional anthropology. Look, if you were going to go out and get yourself an exotic pet, would you go and read the PubMed research files and look for all the scientific data on exactly what nutritional constituents are required by that pet? Or would you just tune into the Big Cat Diaries or a nature program and watch? Because we can learn a great deal about how to feed that pet from the way that pet behaves in nature. And frankly, I think we can do the same with us. We know a huge amount about our history. We know a lot about the way our ancestors lived, and we know a great deal about our diet and our lifestyle as a result of that. And so my goal is, personally, and working with clients, is to help them close what we call the evolution gap, the gap between our very slow-paced and incremental genetic evolution and the tremendous and exponentially increasing rate of change in our civilization and technology. And so when we, for example, is fruit good or bad for us? Well, you know, it depends on who you ask on Twitter. One person says fructose is the most evil, toxic thing in the world. And then another person points out, well, look at the load of vitamins and nutrients that are in them. And the reason there's conflict is because there's one primary thing that neither side is understanding. And that is that fruit was only ever available seasonally. So our ancestors couldn't really overdo fruit. They could overdo fruit on a day, maybe get a stomachache, but they couldn't overdo fruit for a year because it wasn't available consistently. And so it's not simply a matter of what we eat and what we don't eat, but it's a matter of when we eat and what our cycles are like, and making sure that our body gets to go through those seasonal fluctuations.
That's very interesting to see seasonal fluctuations and cater your diet towards that. And if you have to kind of like give us, say, maybe top three things that we could do today to kind of change that or think of food and our relationship with our diet and nutrition differently, what might you suggest?
Well, I think one really great question all the time to ask is like, why am I eating this? Why am I eating this thing right now? One of the things that we find when we ask that question is that a lot of the food that we eat, we're not actually eating it for nutritional sustenance. We're eating it for generally one of two reasons. One is that we have a perception that we need to eat that food for energy today, And I say perception because that's a fundamental misunderstanding of metabolic health. We aren't designed to eat today for energy today. When people are eating, like if somebody goes, oh, I'm low blood sugar and I need to eat today, that's because they're sugar burning. In other words, they're burning the hot, fast burning fuel that'll age them most quickly. It's not meant to be a full-time regular fuel. We're not meant to do that. What we really want to do is move to a metabolism where we're largely fat burning. And when we're largely fat burning, then you aren't eating, like when you eat today, you're eating for next week's energy. So I think that's an important question to ask. Why am I eating this? Because A, if I'm eating it for energy today, then it probably means I'm eating far too many carbohydrates and far too many sugars. Or if I'm eating for the other major reason people eat, and that is emotions, right? We eat to feel better or to stop feeling bad or what have you. And if we're eating food for emotional purposes, well, that's a major problem. And that's the path to addiction. It's the path to unconscious eating. And it's the path to 1 in 3 people dying of cancer and 1 in 3 people dying of heart disease. It's a dangerous road. It's also interesting because a lot of times what happens is people eat something with the perception that it's going to neutralize some negative feeling they're having, or it's going to make them feel good. And how long does it make them feel good? Maybe minutes. And then they feel bad. And often because they ate something not ideal, not only do they stop feeling good, but they start to even feel worse than they did before they ate it, which of course means they have to eat something more. This is incredibly profitable for the food industry, not so good for us.
I remember Vishen Lakhiani, he was taking a few foods. I think one of them was Coke. He went deeper into how much sugar does that drink have, and it was quite eye-opening. Yeah, I kind of get where you're coming from when it comes to the food industry and how, you know, everything's catered to make us eat more. But in terms of nutrition then, what would you say would be a great place to start for someone who wants to get the desired outcomes that they want for their life? Where do you think is the best place to start?
Most people think that going on a diet or improving your health is a question of taking away a bunch of stuff. Like, what are you going to make me stop eating? What should I cut down on? What should I cut out, right? And that's what everybody's worried about. What's really important to understand is that our health is far more dependent upon us getting enough of the good stuff, getting our needs met, then it is eliminating the bad stuff. Maybe one way to describe this I often use is that if we took one of you and put you in a perfect scientific experiment where you ate only perfect human diet foods, you no preservatives, no chemical additives, no excessive garbage fake fats, and no excessive refined sugars, like you just ate natural food from the human diet, then, you know, theoretically, you'd have a really healthy life. And that's true. Except what if we then scientifically withdrew all the vitamin C from what you're eating? Well, you'd get sick and then you'd end up with scurvy and you would die. You would die having never had a Bar One or a Mars bar or ice cream or a pizza. You would die having not even eaten junk food. You would die because you were lacking something. I often hear people talk about like food is medicine. No, it isn't. It's food. If we treat it like it's medicine, then that means we can wait till we get sick and then eat it to heal ourselves. Food is preventative medicine, if anything, but really what food is physical requirements of the body. We require energy and we require non-energy nutrients, and we need to put our focus on getting those things.
Could you give us some examples of these foods that kind of give us that nutritional requirements? You mentioned, you know, honey, you mentioned water, hydration. Are there any other foods to particularly keep in mind?
Well, you know, obviously water isn't really, say, a traditional nutrient It's not like we consider most nutrients. It's a number of other things. It's hydration, and it helps us cleanse ourselves, and of course our body is largely made up of water. But if we're now talking about, say, food substance nutrition, well, like I said, there's energy and then there's non-energy nutrients. So what does that mean? Well, energy largely comes in the form of carbohydrates, fats, and to a limited degree proteins. All of those things are burnable as energy. Then we have non-energy nutrients that we need. And those non-energy nutrients come, say, in the form of, say, vitamins, minerals, amino acids, and you know, various other tiny things that we need to get from food. So the question is, where do we get those things? Well, we know that, for example, protein. There's a huge amount of push that you should get your protein from. You have to get enough meat, or you have to get enough eggs or something to get enough protein in. And then what happens is some people decide, well, you know what? I don't want to eat meat. I want to be a vegetarian, but I can get enough protein. Well, this in itself is another misunderstanding. What I mean by that is that it's not protein that we need in the same way that it's not air we need to breathe. We breathe air because we need oxygen. We eat protein because we need amino acids. And we need like 20 of them, and 9 of them we can't manufacture for ourselves. So we absolutely need to get those. So what that means is that luckily for those people who are not, say, vegan or vegetarian, they can get those things because they come in the form of whole proteins when they eat eggs or meat or fish or poultry or something like that. And then, of course, for people who choose to go down a vegan or vegetarian path, they need to be a little bit more selective because there's no single plant that has all of those. So now they're going to have to go after a variety of legumes and nuts and so forth. But go back to what I was saying originally. If we wanted to figure out, without knowing anything, without knowing the name of a single vitamin, without knowing the name of, what are there? I think 13 vitamins and 16 minerals and the 20 amino acids. If we knew nothing about those things and we still needed to figure out what humans need to eat, we would look at our history. And what we would find historically is that our ancestors have, for the 300 some odd thousand years that sapiens has existed, and for the millions of years that pre-sapiens existed, our ancestors have been incredibly effective hunters, which means that they were eating seasonally available meat and fish, poultry, shellfish, eggs, that sort of stuff. That was a very major staple part of our ancestors' diet. And then, of course, what was also available to us was seasonally available fruits and vegetables. And this is really important because vegetables fight. In other words, when we eat a plant can have both nutrients and anti-nutrients. So let's look at cruciferous vegetables like broccoli or kale or something like that. Incredibly good for us. Very good, supports the liver and cleansing itself. There's definitely good things about cruciferous vegetables. Only at the same time, cruciferous vegetables cause all kinds of other problems in humans as well, including inhibiting the uptake of magnesium. So if somebody's eating far too many cruciferous vegetables, they might start getting leg cramps, their sleep might get disrupted because they're missing magnesium. Well, why is that? Why is it that it's good for us and bad for us? Well, that's because it was seasonal. That's because there was a time when it was available and we ate it and got the good things from it. And then before it started getting too bad for us, Mother Nature took it away and we moved on to something else. That's why I'm saying it's a combination of getting all those, let's call it, ancestral foods, but also recognizing that that there's no perfect meal every day, that with the exception to a degree, I suppose, of animal products, there was nothing that was routinely available in every season.
Wow, that's an amazing response, Eric. Thank you for that. And I think I've never seen food in that kind of context. Eric, I'm just curious to understand, what are your views on non-vegetarianism versus vegetarianism versus vegan? There's a lot of studies that have been done over the years which says non-vegetarian food is not the healthiest. But then, going back to your whole idea of ancestral, heritage, and if you see diet from that context, what exactly are we seeing here? Non-vegetarian food was there all year round. So is that really bad for us? Is that good for us? What are your thoughts on that?
It's a sensitive topic. You're in Mumbai, and so you're in a country that's currently conducting the first ever multi-generational vegetarian experiment on Earth, in Earth's history. And I don't think it's any kind of coincidence that India has epidemic levels of diabetes and obesity expanding all over the place rapidly. And when you have a diet that's largely made up of legumes and chapatis and wheat and dairy products, you're going to create some challenges in that area. In order to answer this question properly, we kind of have to, and not alienate anybody, because it's become a political thing, right? If I suddenly say, well, you should really eat meat, then I'm going to get a bunch of hate mail from the vegans. And then conversely, if I go, well, meat's terrible, I'm going to get hate mail from the carnivores. So let's just take a step back for a minute. There are three primary reasons that people choose to become vegetarian, assuming they didn't just inherit it from their parents. When people convert, there's three primary reasons. One is they have a perception that it's healthier that way. The second one is that they're concerned about animal rights. And the third one is that they're concerned about the health of the planet. These are all admirable values. And I respect the positions. I respect the positions that people take on that from the perspective of wanting those things, wanting health, wanting animals not to suffer, and wanting the environment to be in a good shape. The big challenge is that all three of those things are built on massive misconceptions. You earlier said, well, there's lots of studies out there that show us that non-vegetarian food is bad for us. Well, no, I wouldn't say there's a single study that's ever demonstrated that non-vegetarian food as a food group is bad for us. What I would suggest is there's countless studies out there that have shown that various individual food types are bad for us. And some of those are vegetarian and some of those are non-vegetarian. I mean, there is definitely being a vegetarian in an unhealthy way and being a vegetarian in a healthy way. And so instead of trying to sort of polarize the argument, what I'm really trying to suggest here is that everybody should have the freedom to make that choice for themselves. And in order for them to make that choice, what we're going to have to move, beyond this sort of post-truth world that we're in at the moment where everything becomes politicized. So here's kind of what happens. And I'm telling you this both from my own anecdotal experience and of course, from the benefit of having worked with tens of thousands of people over the last 10 years. What happens for a lot of people is they're eating the standard American diet. And one day they find out about the Hippocrates Institute, or they find out about the PH diet, or they find out about the original fit for life vegetarianism concept, whatever. Something stimulates them. And what happens is they go from being a standard American diet person or a standard Western diet person to a healthy vegetarian model. And what happens is within a month, they lose weight, they feel better, their skin improves, like they definitely feel better. And they make a decision at that point that it was their conversion to vegetarianism that was the issue, because that was the largest identity shift they made. If somebody goes from the standard American diet, standard Western diet, and they eliminate refined sugar, and they eliminate dairy products, and they eliminate wheat, and they eliminate meat and so forth, all of those, none of those things write to their identity the way becoming a vegetarian does. Nobody comes along and says, oh, you're a non-sugar eater now. But they, oh, you're vegan now. And it becomes an identity. And so people then make the assumption that the health improvements they made was relative to the identity shift they made. Well, what I can tell you in science is that if you want to conduct an experiment, what you have to do is have everything under control and test only one thing. But when somebody goes from the standard American diet and then they cut out sugar, wheat, dairy products, meat, processed food, flavorings, all that garbage, they now have like 8 variables, and they will never really know which of those variables had what kind of impact on their health. So this is exactly what happened to me. In 1991, I was sick and tired and grossed out by my life, and I was on all these medications and what have you. And I sat down and had a conversation with a bunch of my friends. A few of my friends introduced me to Tony Robbins. He was into vegetarianism at the time. Bam, I became a vegetarian. I gave up dairy products, sugar, processed food. I gave up toxic stuff. And 30 days later, I'd lost 35 pounds. All my allergies were gone. I no longer needed medication. I saved myself having to have a surgery. And I assumed it was because I became a vegetarian. But it wasn't. It was because I'd given up eating low quality meat. It was because I'd given up eating disastrous dairy products. It's because I'd given up eating processed foods, refined sugar. Like, I had changed a multitude of things. And when I achieved optimal health, and I mean optimal, like I'm 50 years old and I could run a marathon tomorrow if I wanted to. I'm in incredibly good shape. I feel good about my health in a way that I didn't even in my early 20s. When I found that, it was because I then started to duplicate a more traditional human diet. And humans have traditionally eaten meat. So hang on a second, because now I know there's some vegetarians and they're like, eh, it's not true. It's not true. The real issue here around nutrition and meat is that when vegetarians quote science that indicates meat being bad for us, there's only two ways that that happens. The one is that they are comparing against processed meats. So this is a very common thing that they go grab a study based on processed meats with all kinds of nitrates or, I don't know, whatever, like garbage in them. And of course, they're going to win that competition. The other way they win is by outright lying. And there, I'm not going to name names here at the moment, but there is a very prominent vegan doctor who has a very big website, you know, talking all about nutrition. And I was really fascinated because he presents a really great argument. So I went and read a number of the articles that he'd put forward that kind of challenged the notion of meat eating. By the way, very responsibly written, it appears, because there's sources that go back to the studies that he is quoting. And some people stop at the headline. Other people actually read the article. Other people actually click the links and go and read the original research that the person quoted. And that's what I did. And what I found is that this particular author was misquoting the studies, was taking stuff out of context to make the argument that he wanted to make, because he's a political vegan. The health claims about meat eating and not meat eating are inaccurate. The next issue is animal rights. And this is a really difficult one, because I don't like the fact that an animal has to die for me to eat it. I don't like that. I've gone hunting and fishing myself, and it's quite a moment to recognize that that's going on. But it's also neither good nor bad. What I mean is that every animal is ultimately going to die, and so are we. And if we're gonna stop eating meat in order to prevent animals from dying, then we should stop having children too, because they're also going to die. Like, death is not the issue. The issue is quality of life. And if PETA and these and the more militant branch of the sort of vegan faith, if you will, would focus on animal rights rather than on the final act of death, then what they could do is massively improve the quality of life of the animals that are in livestock conditions. which incidentally would also serve to improve the quality of the health of the people consuming those animals. So I am much more focused on the quality of the animal's life and the manner of its death than trying to prevent its death. And then thirdly, when we talk about the environment, the science on this is incredibly clear, but spun badly by people that are politicized on this argument. And that is this: yes, feedlot farming is terrible for the environment. Monocrop farming is terrible for the environment. Feedlot beef, oh my God, horrible. But so is monocrop avocado farming. You know, something like 25 to 30% of the deforestation of Mexico right now is due to avocado farming. Nothing to do with beef. It's avocados. The fact is there's nothing vegan about being vegan. When you eat an avocado, you have to recognize that in order to grow avocados, they have to clear 40 acres of rainforest, which means killing over 10,000 animals. They then need to kill a couple thousand animals a year just to keep them out of the avocado grove. It's an environmental disaster. Whereas full spectrum, holistic farming, when you farm in a way that mimics the environment the best way possible, like regenerative farming, regenerative beef farming, then you are actually improving conditions based on what we've done, and it's carbon positive. So regenerative beef farming is actually carbon positive, whereas monocrop avocado farming or monocrop beef farming is incredibly bad. So you guys got more out of me on the vegan thing than I'm normally willing to do on a podcast, but there you go.
Thank you so much for that, Eric. And one of the things that I'm really curious to understand is, because majority of our listeners are anywhere between 18 to 25, probably in university, high school or school, working with people like coaches might be expensive for most of us. And so, you know, you spoke a little bit about self-hacking the whole the diet, the nutrition, the well-being side of things. What is that advice you'd give to a university student, for example, who's on like a shoestring budget, to kind of take care of their health and to choose the right foods? What can he or she do or they do right now that can kind of impact their quality of life, especially with the food that they eat?
Students are, they're being killed by convenience. You know, you go to university and you you buy the meal plan from the university, and then that they farm that meal plan out to the lowest bidder and you get that food. And that's the way that works. And then even if you're not on the food plan at the university, then what are you doing? Well, you don't have time to cook. You don't, and you're on a budget, so you don't want to do dishes. So, you know, it's off to Pizza Delight or McDonald's or, you know, or whatever. So convenience is the major problem here. And I think that one of the things that's very difficult for students to appreciate is they don't have the perspective of time, and it's really difficult. You know, I often joke that you're not really an adult until you're about 20 years old, really. And so that means that by the time you're 22 years old, you're really like 2 years old. You know, in terms of your real adult life experience, you're a two-year-old adult, right? What that means is as you start to have your first, and I don't mean that to be condescending. I'm 50 years old. I remember I have a very, like I really am in touch with what I was like at 18, 19, and 20.
Wait, you're 30. You're actually 30 years old.
Yeah, that's right. I'm a 30-year-old adult. Exactly correct. but what I'm kind of getting at is what students don't often appreciate is the long-term consequence of their short-term behavior. And so the long-term consequence of taking convenient food right now means that every possibility of at the age of 34 or 35 years old, sitting down in your GP's office and being told that you're now pre-diabetic and that you're going to need to be put on medication. And by the way, while it doesn't need to be this way, the average GP is still telling people that they need to be on these drugs for the rest of their lives because they have, quote, a chronic disease, right? Diabetes or pre-diabetes is the development of a chronic disease. In other words, a disease that you will have for the rest of your life. That's not a nice conversation to have. And the fact is that conversation doesn't come up because of stuff you started doing in your 30s. That conversation happens because of stuff you started doing when you're 18. You are carving out your future health with your teeth every single day. And every single time you choose Coke or refined sugar or trans fats, every time you choose processed food, every time you choose convenience in that sense, you are, if not taking minutes off your life, it is absolutely going to damage your quality of life starting about 45 minutes after you eat the food and continuing into your late years. What I mean by that is, I do this with audience all the time, especially students. I love doing this game with students. You can have 1,000 students in the room and then I'll ask them, everybody join with me and make the sound that represents the way you feel if we were about to order a bunch of pizza and ice cream and Coke and everything else. Everybody, one, two, three. And then everybody just cheers. Yeah, wow. And they, like the huge celebration. That is the sound that represents what's going on in their body. Well, hold on a second. If that's what if that is what is happening inside their body, what chemicals do you think they're producing in their body? Serotonin, dopamine? Even before we've started eating the food, they're already producing feel-good drugs. No wonder we've got a problem, because now in that feel-good state, they start eating those foods. And that means that those foods are even tastier than they really are, because you're full of feel-good drugs that make everything brighter and everything nicer. Then I ask everybody, please now make the sound that represents the way your body feels 45 minutes after the pizza and the ice cream and the Coca-Cola. And they all know it. They all know that that's how it is. The trouble is that when you're 21 years old or 20 something, you aren't so good at connecting future consequences with present day actions. And it's something that comes with time and experience. And so what that means is, if anybody really wants to change their future right now, what they should do, honestly, is pick the food up in their hand, look at their food, and imagine, A, how that food's going to make them feel an hour from now instead of how it's going to make them feel right now. And then also imagine what eating that food on a regular basis over a 20-year period is going to mean when they're sitting in their doctor's office at 35 years old.
Wow, that kind of gave me a huge reality check there, Rick, but thanks for that. And I guess, yeah, you're right. I mean, the pizza, the Cokes, the soft drinks. Yeah, definitely a lot of sugar. And I guess that kind of makes it very addictive. Yeah, I really like the thought of just picking up the food that you're just about to put in your mouth and saying, what's the consequence 20 years from now? But don't you also agree that like food in itself also can be relished and had and enjoyed, versus just looking at food as just fuel for the body?
In this sense, we should make sure that we understand the priority. The priority is that the food is good for our body. That's the priority. And then the luxury is that it can taste good and make us feel nice. That's the luxury. You know, some years ago, I was flying through an airport, and obviously, generally, they don't serve food in airports. They serve pseudo food, fake food, bad food, junk food in airports, generally. But I'm going through this one airport somewhere in the States. I feel like it was in Austin, Texas, but I can't remember for sure. In any event, I go along and they have this farm-to-table restaurant right there in the airport. It was incredible. And you could, you know, make your own wrap out of these really nice grain-free tortilla-type wraps. And then they had all the different meats, all from free-range organic farming, and then all the vegetables, and then all the spices and the flavors. And then they had this huge array of little pots of spices that had about 50 different spices. And I sat there thinking to myself, wow, that's how it is for us. We truly choose food based on what our tongue wants. We get to choose our food for flavor, when the vast majority of people on this planet are lucky to get food if they get it at all. And so the first thing we have to recognize, that food is for nutrition. That is the highest directive. And anytime we are eating food without that highest directive in mind, we're causing a potential problem. In other words, if we're making a compromise and we're going to say, oh, well, I'm going to eat this food, even though I know it's bad for me. Well, that's not necessarily bad one time. But the problem is, if we're really honest, it's not just one time for most of us. It's consistent. You're asking, like, what could a student do, or what could a young entrepreneur do to start things off? All I would say is this. Every single day, focus first on getting your body's nutritional needs met. And then once those are met, then you can go after the more, you know, fun, emotionally nourishing foods. But you know what the kicker is? You might find that once your body's nutritional needs are met, that your emotional needs aren't so strong.
Wow. Thanks a lot for that, Eric. So when you talk about nutritional needs, is there like some kind of calculation that we could do or start off with that can kind of guide us onto what we should be eating? Is it like a tracker, or is it like a calculator, depending on like height or body weight or something along those lines?
No, we at WildFit, we don't do measurements. We don't do calorie counting. We don't do weighing of food. We do easy. We basically say, these are the foods that we eat, that if you eat them and you eat them correctly, then what you tend to do is your body tends to communicate with you really effectively. We don't really, look, I know that in the generation that you're talking to, they'd love to have an app with a tracker and they can photograph what they're eating, and then the app can tell them, yes, you should eat more of that and what have you. In this case, I'm going to suggest we think more for ourselves. And all I'm going to suggest is, if you are eating food that makes you hungry, that's a clue, don't you think? Because that's what happens. We eat food that makes us hungry. When you eat really heavy sugar or carbohydrate-rich foods, it stimulates your appetite and makes you want to eat more. So of course, you know, one of the things that we can do is curb that, really seek to have days, maybe even weeks, where we aren't consuming such heavy carbohydrates. And by the way, for anybody who's studying, anybody who's a student in school or just in the, you know, early stages of starting their business, sugar is the best way to blunt your mind. It makes your short-term memory fuzzy, and it makes your, generally, it makes your mind slower. And so if anybody's looking to optimize their cognitive capacity, then reducing their sugar and carbohydrate intake is an awesome thing to do.
And what should you supplement that with? So what are the foods that you would recommend?
When you say supplement, you're saying, well, I'm taking a carbohydrate out, so what should I replace it with? Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Well, again, the way we do it at WildFit is we look at humans as the descendants of people that survived going through seasons. So in other words, there were, say, four sub-Saharan seasons that our ancestors went through. One of those seasons would have been, say, summer. And what's going on in summer? Well, you know, there's a lot of rain. There's lots of vegetables growing. There's some summer berries happening. There's some seeds happening. And there's lots of good hunting. You know, the rains are there. It's a good time. It's a time of abundance. And then you move into fall. And in fall, what you might notice is that there's now a lot more fruit available and a lot more root vegetables available. So fall is a season of carbohydrate-rich foods. And the reason it's there is that, or I shouldn't say the reason it's there, how we responded to that is because over multiple generations, our bodies learned that after fall comes winter when there's huge calorie restriction. And so our bodies use the fall as a time for fattening up. So when we are eating lots of carbohydrates, when we're eating lots of fruit or any carbohydrates that stimulate heavy insulin production, our body learns that winter's coming. Our body knows that winter's coming. You know, we metabolize that sugar. We put some of it in our blood for blood sugar. We store some glycogen in our muscles and liver. And then we start storing fat so that we can survive the winter. And so in the fall, what we've been eating? Well, probably, as I said, lots of fruits and root vegetables and nuts, you know, all the fall season foods. Then we would have moved into winter. And in winter, it would have been tough because this is drought season. There's not so much water. There's not many plants growing. And so in winter, there probably would have been limited amounts of hunting. This would be a season of fasting. Our ancestors wouldn't have fasted on purpose, but Mother Nature would have probably forced some fasting during this time of lack. There's not so much water. The hunting's not so good. There's not so many plants growing. But at the same time, what we would have had fat stores that would have helped us get through that time. Then what would happen magically? The rains would come. And when the rains hit, and the rains are an incredibly important thing in that part of the world where our ancestors come from, because in fact, many of the antelope and wildebeest and zebras and stuff like that, they have a breeding season that lasts about 6 weeks, and yet they all have their babies on almost the same day. Even though they're gestating for different periods, they do that. And the day they have their babies is the day the rain is coming. And there's all kinds of reasons they do that, but the biggest one is to make sure the lions don't get all the babies. If they had the babies all scattered out through the month, the lions would just eat them all. But now they have them all on one day, the lions are full, more of the babies make it. But guess what happens in spring? Lots of plants are growing, green shoots and, you know, green vegetables, that kind of stuff, and also incredibly good hunting season. And so in spring, we would have probably had quite a lot of plant availability, but not so much carbohydrate plant availability, more like the green leafy variety, and also meat from a plentitude hunting. And so we tend to want to follow a map along those lines, not necessarily over the course of the year, but we want to make sure that our body has the opportunity to experience all of those seasons.
That's a lot of information. And I guess, you know, it goes back to what you anyway said, you know, follow the way, you know, your ancestors kind of ate. And I think what you've done is brilliantly mapped it out from season to season based on availability. The problem is we have too much. And as a result of too much, and there's too much choice. And as a result of that, we make some compromising decisions. Eric, thank you so much. And I'm just going to wrap up with some quick fire questions.
Yep, go for it.
The goal is not to overthink it. It's just to speak your mind. What is your favorite book?
Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl.
Oh, love that one. Favorite podcast?
Boy, it really depends on my mood. I'm going to have to give you four. I can't do it any way. I really love the Mind Valley podcast. I think they do a great job of bringing people in. Joe Rogan is always fascinating to me. Tim Ferriss, of course. And I also really like Dave Asprey's Bulletproof Radio.
Awesome. What's your favorite song?
Oh, that's also really tough. It's very mood dependent. Jeez, but if I really dive down into it, I it's going to be awfully cliched, but I'd have to say Yesterday.
Nice. You mean the one by Beatles?
Yes.
Awesome. Favorite movie?
Star Wars. I know. Ridiculous.
No, respect it. First thing you do before you go to sleep?
Close my eyes.
What's the first thing you do when you wake up?
I'll answer both questions a little bit better. What I like to do before I go to sleep is I like to imagine everything that's going to be amazing about tomorrow. I just love to do that. I find I sleep better and I find that I wake up with more energy. And then I like to do the same thing when I wake up in the morning. I'm basically asking myself in the morning, what am I most grateful for? What am I happiest about? What am I most excited about for today? Setting that frame before I fall asleep and setting that frame when I wake up in the morning changes everything. And you know, whenever I slip out of that habit, I notice. I really notice.
Do you think it impacts the way like your next day goes?
I made an observation as a kid and it went like this, that most of the year, my mom had to kick my ass to get me out of bed, right? Get out of bed, like get to school. But there was one day of the year where it was like reversal day, where everything was like a reverse day. And it was the one day of the year where my mom, the night before, she would say to me and my brother, if you two little shits get out of bed before 6 o'clock in the morning, I'm going to kick your ass. I'm kidding. She didn't speak to us like that, but that's how it felt, right? And of course you can guess what day that was, right? Christmas. And so what was going on? I realized that on the school days, I was dreading what was coming and therefore I didn't want to wake up and couldn't wake up. But on Christmas Day, I was so excited that my body woke me up. And I'll tell you, to this day, I almost never use alarms. In fact, even when I do use an alarm, I use the alarm as a backstop just in case. In other words, if I need to be up at 6:30, I set the alarm for 6:45 just in case. And I will tell you a good 95% of the time I wake up before the alarm comes off because I'm enjoying my life.
Wow, I really like that answer. I guess it goes back to the point that you made very well about do something that drives you. And as a result of that, you just keep doing it. I guess that's where you get your energy from, especially on stage as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's the one word that describes you and why?
I probably would have to go with curious.
What are your views on coffee?
That's hardly fair. I just finished telling you I really like Dave Asprey's Bulletproof podcast, and now you're asking me about coffee. I will tell you that I am not a fan, generally speaking, of coffee if it is not somebody's choice. What I mean is that if somebody has to wake up in the morning and have a coffee in order to function as a human being, if somebody has to have a cup of coffee at 2 o'clock in the afternoon because they can't keep themselves awake, then there's a problem. And so I am not a big fan of any product that seeks to take people's choice away. And coffee does that. It seeks to take your choice away. It wants you to be addicted to it and so that you don't have a choice about whether you drink it or not. I'm not a fan of that. That said, there are people who have functional relationships with coffee. They drink it occasionally. And I have no judgment about that if that's how they want to do it. I have had exactly one cup of coffee in over 30 years and I had it at Dave Asprey's house.
All right. Thank you so much. And what's your views on keto?
Keto is a season, not a lifestyle.
Fair enough. And what's your view on intermittent fasting?
We don't use intermittent fasting within the WildFit program, but that's only because the program is designed to be very followable. In other words, the more rules you create for people, the more damage you do to people's self-esteem. In other words, when somebody goes on a diet, if you give them like 50 rules, and they break 10 of those rules, they've actually damaged their self-esteem each time they break one of those rules, which makes it harder for them to adhere to the other rules. So one of the things that we've done is we've made WildFit incredibly easy to follow. And people always, by the end of 2 weeks, they're like, this is the best I've ever done ever. Yeah, well, we made it really like easy for them to get that way. Intermittent fasting requires willpower. And for many people, it's difficult to manage it that way. That said, nature imposed various types of fasting, including intermittent fasting, on our ancestors on a regular basis, and our bodies have evolved the requirement for fasting from time to time. So I believe that it's incredibly important for the body to do short-term fasts like intermittent fasting. Think of it this way. If you've got a factory and you want to do refurbishment of the factory, say a digestion factory that is responsible for processing food and turning it into nutrients and energy, then what you would want to do maintenance on that factory is empty it out and let it get cleansed and repaired. And most people's digestive system is never empty enough for them to do that. And they wonder why they have all these digestive problems. So I think intermittent fasting can be a really good idea in that sense. And longer term fasting, well, absolutely necessary for the body. In fact, we mentioned earlier in this podcast that there are three energy sources for the body, sugar, fat, but we also talked about protein. But what's really fascinating about protein is that your body, when it does finally resort to burning protein, which is a fuel of last resort, your body is so intelligent that it burns the old and sick proteins first in a function called autophagy, which is basically your body cleansing out the old and the sick. And it's really important that your body gets a chance to do that. Unfortunately, most people will never fast long enough to get to that stage.
Wow. So what do you recommend the fasting period to be? 16 hours?
In terms of the intermittent fasting, there's all kinds of different numbers on this depending on your metabolism and how old you are. So I don't even want to anybody can Google that for themselves. There's tables that'll tell you those things. Go and check out what JJ Virgin or Dave Asprey says about intermittent fasting. They speak about it a lot. What I would say to you is that the fasting I am more interested in, my basic rules of thumb are this. One is I want to make sure that most nights I can go to bed on a completely empty stomach. So what does that mean? It means A, eating a non-complicated meal and eating it 3, 4, 5 hours before you go to bed, and then sleeping on an empty stomach. That's important to me that I get to do that from time to time, if not quite regularly. And then the third thing is I believe in doing full day and up to 3 day fasts on a fairly regular basis, say once a month or something like that, to allow your body to do what it needs to do.
Wow. Don't you feel hungry during the day?
We talk a lot in WildFit about the six hungers. And if anybody's curious about the full six hungers, I've posted recently about them on my Instagram account, so you can go see them there. But there are six primary reasons that we eat. And we show people how to neutralize the five ghost hungers so that they only are left with nutritional hunger. And once you've done that, what's crazy is that when you go on a fast, the truth is, as we mentioned earlier, when you are eating, you're generally not eating for your nutrition today. You're eating for your nutrition next month. And you're also not eating for your energy today. You're eating for your energy, say, next week. So when somebody is really nutritionally topped up and they're running their metabolism clean, they can go a day or two without food and barely even notice. The hunger that kicks in when you fast is not your physical body demanding food. It's generally emotional hunger of some kind.
Oh, wow. Okay. And just to wrap this up, one final question. What are your top five tips for young entrepreneurs?
Don't try to do it all by yourself. That's number one. Number two is spend as much of your time doing what you love as possible. In school, we were taught that the harder something looked, the more reward we got for doing it. In your business, you want to do it the other way around. You want to get the maximum reward for the stuff that you enjoy the most. Number three, stop worrying about stuff all the time. At the end of the day, we survive just about everything that we think is unsurvivable, and we get stronger and better as a result of it. We know this from video games. Any young entrepreneur that's starting a business now has probably played a video game. Let me say this. When you get to the hard part of the game, what do? Freak out? You dwell on it? Do you drink it away? No. You celebrate that you're at the hard part of the game because you know that's when you're going to level up and you're going to get to the next level. Same thing with business. When the day gets hard, when the bank says no, or a client rejects an order, or a key member of staff leaves, and that's the hard level, that's when you say game on and level up time. Number four, get mentorship. Get mentorship. And I mean get mentorship from somebody who's been there. This is different than, say, you know, the get help, and that is like have people around you. This is make sure that you've got people in your life that have started businesses, that have grown businesses, that can really be there for you on the tough days. You do not have to reinvent the wheel. And last thing is put money aside. Don't imagine for a moment that you are going to grow your first business into a phenomenal financial windfall. You may be that lucky, but in the meantime, the statistics suggest that that's not going to be the case. And it's a really good idea to be working on both methods of getting wealthy. There are two ways to get wealthy, fast and slow. And a lot of entrepreneurs, because they're generally optimistic people, want the fast. And that's great. Go for it. I did it. I made a lot of money fast. I was lucky. But I also make money slow. And that is something that I'm grateful for, because there's also been times where I've had really big setbacks in business. And of course, because I also worked on making money slow, I wasn't relying on all eggs being in one basket.
Wow. Thank you so much, Eric. It's been an absolute pleasure. So much that I've learned. I guess we'll have to invite you again. Thank you so much for joining us. And I'm sure that you've given so much inspiration, motivation, and a lot of insight to our audience. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Keep doing what you guys are doing. You know, when I started my business, this kind of stuff didn't exist, you know, and I really love now that there are these podcasts and great information. You asked for five things. The sixth one is listen to podcasts like this. Listen to people who have gotten things done. You know, you're in London. Like, one of my favorite entrepreneurs in London is a guy named Daniel Priestley. I would follow him on social. He's got great ideas about business, particularly in the European theater. Like, you guys are doing very good and important work. Keep doing it. And I hope that people continue to tune in. You never really know, but in my experience, every single time, even now where I feel like I've got a little bit of wisdom under my belt, one thing you begin to realize is the more you learn, the more you don't know. And so the more you want to learn. And I think that's that's something we want to inspire in all entrepreneurs. They're not arriving at knowing everything. They're arriving at knowing everything they can.
Wow. That was beautiful. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Thanks, guys.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to our podcast. If you enjoyed it, drop a review wherever you're listening to this. And for weekly content, subscribe to our podcast channel. And for more updates, check our social media channels attached in the show notes below. Thank you very much.